This is the UVic Military Oral History Program interview with Mr. Tom Walton, recorded on March 14, 2012, at the University of Victoria, interviewed by Candace Erickson. Mr. Walton, do I have your permission to record this interview?
Yes, you do.
And please begin by stating your full name.
My name is Thomas Henry Frederick Walton.
Wonderful. So maybe you can start by telling me your reasons for enlisting.
Well, my father was killed in 1942. I was born in early 1943. I was raised by a mother and a grandmother. And when I got into my teens, I was not very well disciplined. So in 1959, I joined the militia under the Young Soldier Training Plan, and my commanding officer happened to be one of my teachers at school, who realized that I wasn't doing very well at school, but I was doing very well with the military side of the house. So with my mother's permission, I joined the military when I was 17. I joined the Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry. And it was the best thing that ever happened. I was instantly had a high degree of discipline imposed on me, like it or not, but I stayed for 35 years.
Mm-hmm. So why did you choose to join the Royal Canadian Engineers?
Well, originally I was infantry, and I was on a pioneer course, which are actually infantry engineers. They're infanteers, but they train in a lot of engineer work. And while I was on the course, they were running a bridging camp in Chilliwack, the engineers were, three field squadron at the time. And I went on this bridging camp. As a matter of fact, I went on two of them, and I enjoyed the work so much that I decided to change after 3 years in the infantry.
So how did you come to be posted to the Canadian Airborne?
How did I come to be posted? Mm-hmm. Well, in 1966, I believe it was, in part two orders, they were asked, while I was stationed in Germany, they were asking for volunteers for the soon-to-be-formed Canadian Airborne Regiment. And when I had originally joined the Army, I wanted to go on a paratroop course, but I was posted to a battalion in Victoria, British Columbia, which obviously doesn't parachute. So I'd always wanted to do that type of work, and I'd met a couple of friends of mine that had gone to the Airborne when I came back in 68. I immediately went in to go on the jump course, and they found out I had an ulcer, unbeknownst to me. So it took them about a year and a half to get rid of this, and then I finally went on the jump course. But I always wanted to, I think mainly just to see if I could do it. And then after a while, I got to really like it. It's hard to leave it.
What did you like most about it?
Oh, the excitement, the camaraderie. You're with, first of all, you're with all volunteers that join the Canadian Army as volunteers. Then you're with another group of volunteers that jump out of airplanes. Not always perfectly good airplanes, but... And I just found that the morale and everything was so strong. It was really a good outfit. It was an excellent outfit.
So when did you go to Cyprus? I know you went before the Turkish invasion.
Yeah, I left Canada on the 8th of April, 1974.
And what were you to do there?
I was the civilian labor NCO, which was, I was in charge of all the Greek and Turkish Cypriots that were working for us. But I had a Greek foreman who had been there forever, knew everybody by their first names, knew their wives and kids and everybody else. So I was more or less a figurehead. I would drive around with a payroll. If you imagine that, a big suitcase full of money, and drive around and pay them every 2 weeks. So.
Did you enjoy doing that job?
Loved it. I got to know him and his family. He had 10 kids, and by this time he had 5 living in Calgary.
What was Cyprus like before the invasion?
Great. Beautiful. It's called the Island of Love. I don't know why they're still fighting over there, but that's what it's actually called. And it's a very nice temperature, warm all the time. People were like anywhere else. They've seen Canadians here. They always seem to draw people. I think it must be our mannerisms, the way we are. But everywhere I've been with the Canadian flag, except for Yugoslavia, it's good.
Did you notice any tensions between the two sides, Turkish and Greek?
On the Green Line, Yes, but in the workplace, no. In some places, there's Turks and Greeks working together, and they'd known each other since childhood from the same village.
So, were you given any, like, rules of engagement before the invasion?
Before the invasion, well, we didn't know the invasion was coming.
Mm-hmm.
But after the initial assault on the island, the ammunition was just put out between the buildings and said, help yourself. And we did.
So what was your reaction when you found out that the invasion had occurred?
Well, it wasn't hard to figure out because we were on roll call one morning and all of a sudden these super sabers come out of the clouds because we weren't far from the airport and we could see the bombs leaving the aircraft right onto the runway. And shortly after that, there's I don't know how many dozens of cargo aircraft went right over our camp, and our camp was on a bit of a rise, so we were probably 300, 400 feet there above us. They were probably 300, 400 feet, and we could actually see the paratroopers standing in the door, Turkish airborne. And then a few minutes later, we could see them dropping down on the plane. I can't remember what the plane is called, but it was past the airport, and that would have been north of Nicosia, northeast. So we figured something was going on then.
How did you feel when you saw those planes?
Personally, I thought I got pretty excited. I said, well, look at this. You know, it was interest. I mean, we were scheduled to do a paradrop on the island. It's just continuation training. And obviously that was canceled. But I was more interested, to be quite honest. A lot of wondering what's going to happen next. What are we going to do? You know, because there wasn't very many of us there. It was less than 500. So there's a lot of questions in your mind, but I didn't feel any at the exact time any anxiety or anything. It was more interest.
So how did the sort of rules of engagement change after the Turkish invasion happened?
Well, we weren't sure. I can't remember them telling us if we were allowed to open fire or whatever. I mean, it was basically the officers put the ammunition out there and said, help yourself, because we didn't know if we were going to be attacked or not.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the rules of engagement sort of went out the window. Because I know they did some fighting downtown. They opened up, I knew the sergeant that was in charge of it. He finally had to open fire on both sides because they were in the middle and they wouldn't stop firing. So he had medium and heavy machine guns there. He opened up both sides. So that's the rules of engagement. They stopped firing, by the way.
So did your previous training prepare you for this situation?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were a pretty gung-ho outfit. You know, we didn't go looking for trouble. We weren't too scared of anything coming our way. More afraid of losing than anything else. You know.
So after the Turkish invasion, you said you no longer had any civilian laborers to oversee.
No, I didn't. No. Matter of fact, when I finally contacted my foreman, when he finally came back, he had lost his village from the Turks. They were coming down from the north, northeast, northwest, I believe it is. And he had lost his village and everything that he owned. So they started to come back in dribs and drabs, and then the foreman was also concerned about how were we going to pay the Turks, because they'd all gone over to the Turk side. And I ended up delivering the money over there. That was probably the scaredest I was. But then again, I helped my foreman out as much as I could. I got him some cots and that from the embedding and other things that to help him set up for his five kids and his wife. So
you continue to perform at least some of your duties as the...
Oh, yeah. And after, I guess, about... September, things started to go back to normal, and they came back to work, and it was pretty well normal. As a matter of fact, in August, we started sending people back to Canada that were going on career courses that were posted and things like that. I wasn't on any of that, so I stayed until December. So.
And you mentioned that you sort of became the bodyguard for Colonel Clay B. Can you sort of... What was that like?
Well, what happened was, my CO or officer commanding was a guy by the name of Harry's, Major Harry's. He's about 6'3", blonde, tough as they come. He said, we were at the headquarters one day, and he said he got a phone call, and he called me, and he said, Colonel Beatty's going up the airport to talk to the Turks and the Greeks, and he's all by himself, so you got no job, so you're going with him. Look after him. So Harry's driver was there, Bezinas, he's in there, and he asked, he said, well, can I take the sergeant up there? He said, yeah, go ahead. So that's what happened. We got up there, and we had to leave our weapons behind. We weren't allowed to take our weapons, which we didn't like too much. So as we were going across this field, we started to see bodies, and I seen this one Turk with a pistol in his hand, so I took the pistol and put it in my pocket just in case. And we finally got to Colonel Beatty, and he knew why we were coming. So there must have been some kind of communication. I knew he had a radio, so... And basically, that's how I became his bodyguard for the day.
So you're just his bodyguard for that one day?
Pretty well, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he already had a fellow with him, Master Corporal Phil Barakoff, who was his radio operator, driver radio operator. Mm-hmm. Phil was 2 Commando. He was PPCLI. So we got there. He said, "I'm glad to see you guys. How many more is coming?" We said, "We're it."
So you received the Order of Military Merit.
Yeah.
For your actions during the retaking of Nicosia Airport, right?
Well, we didn't retake it. It never was handed over to the Greeks or the Turks.
Oh.
It was just the actions of the whole day. As soon as we finished that day, I guess we were out there 18 to 20 hours. Mm-hmm. It was dark out. When they finally told us to go back to camp, and Bezinas and I, who was with me all day, we sat down and wrote out a statement. And... sometime after that, the word started coming around and say, "Hey, you guys are getting a medal." And we said, "What for?" You know, because you guys were always, you know, "What the hell did I do that these other guys wouldn't have done?" You know, but they thought we were worthy of it, so they gave it to us. Governor General gave it to us.
Mm-hmm. So, can you describe that day? Does it stick clearly in your mind?
In Cyprus?
Yeah, the day that sort of.
Oh yeah, except. That even the next day when we wrote out the statement, we were trying to figure out, put things into sequence of events, how to categorize them or when they happened. In my original statement, I had one paragraph that we had to move around. We didn't have computers in those days, so we had arrows going. This happened then and all that. Yeah, I'll never forget it.
Can you tell me about it?
Yeah. Once we got down to Colonel Beatty, it was like a little bumper car park. It was a little amusement park. And where they had these bumper cars, they had all these Greek prisoners. And what I was trying to do was get a picture of these. As soon as I held up my camera, this one Turkish paratrooper pulled a pistol on me. So anyway, I moved around to the side of the building, and that's the picture, one of the pictures he got with that little guy. He was the officer. And he let me take the picture, but Bezinas took the picture, and I was trying to get him to move around. I was trying to get him to move around so we could get a picture of the prisoners, but it didn't happen. Yeah, this is my belt. CDs.
Mm-hmm.
It's that airplane I showed you that was burning on the runway for... It's the day we left. Seen him last week.
Yeah.
I don't know what rank he was. Could have been a company commander or a battalion commander, because on one side of the road, which would have been over there, there was troops as far as you could see, Turkish troops lined up. And right this way, there was a slope going up. Okay, it is here. That was what they call RAF Nicosia, Royal Air Force Nicosia. That's where the British were. But they were gone by this time. That was their married quarters. So the Turks were coming this way, going up to try and take that. That's that guy laying there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes, another one.
So they wouldn't let us take pictures of the prisoners, and eventually The firing started. So we're in this building. What is it? Sort of like a brick building just off to the side here. Buzz and I dove for cover, and it was the Greeks that were firing. And there was a machine gun coming right through there. The machine gun fire was coming right through, and we were facing the Turks. And we're there for about 5 or 10 minutes, maybe not that long. And we were leaning against the Coca-Cola side, and about that far away from Buzz's shoulder, this bang, this bullet hit. So that obviously came from the Turk side. Maybe it was a wake-up. So then we heard this yelling going on, so we assumed they were saying, ceasefire, ceasefire, and they did. So then Colonel Beatty asked me to come with them. Or no, in the meantime, I got speaking to some of the Turkish soldiers, and I said, does anybody speak German? This Sprechen Deutsch, this one guy came over and he said, yeah, I Sprechen Deutsch. He'd spent 4 years in Germany as a, what they call a guest arbeiter, guest worker. And his German was probably about the same as mine. So the Turkish officer said something to him, and he said, we're going to be the dolmetschers, the interpreters. So I said, okay. So we got the Colonel Beatty convinced the Turkish officer to go up and speak to the Greek commander. And you guys will come along with us, me and this Turkish Lance Corporal. So we did. So we went up, and I can't remember the result was that they didn't attack. The Turks didn't attack, and the Greeks were in no position to attack. They didn't. They had nowhere near the manpower that the Turks did. And so then we went back down, and I said to Colonel Beatty, I just seen him marching some guys off the road down there. I'd like to go check it out. And he said, go ahead. He said, see what you can do. And just as we come around the corner, they shot them, the prisoners. They just shot them. And we found one alive there, and the road was going down like that, and the prisoners were over here, and they shot them there. We found one over here and one there. The guy over here was still alive. The rest were dead. And the one over here, he had been shot in the leg. And we thought he just had a real bleeder. And Buzz had just finished the first aid instructor's course. That's about 4 months long. That was, you're almost a surgeon when you come out of that. So he said, Tom, hold on to his shoulders. I'm going to put some traction on his leg. And he did. The leg came off. So this particular guy, he was 22, and he was asking us in perfect English if we had water. We didn't have any water because we had to leave everything behind. So I went over to the Turks and tried to get to the other side of the road to get some water, and they wouldn't give it to us. In the meantime, the British medics came down with an ambulance, but they would only take one, the one guy. And I said, what's wrong with you guys? Well, we don't have room. I said, well, pile them on top of each other. You know, you're only going a kilometer or less up to the hospital. So we got in a bit of a bun fight there. We're out of here, and they took off. By the time they came back, the guy had died in our arms. He rattled and... So he died, and then we were going around a bit, and that's when we found these people that were shot in their vehicles, because they were driving up to the airport. There's Morfu Road was the name of the road there, that's right here, and I guess they were just trying to get up to the airport to go to work. Unfortunately, they were in uniform, and they were shot, M-O-R. P-H-O-U.
Oh, perfect. Thank you.
So, we didn't see them get shot, but they were, if you see, this is a Cyprus Airways van. You can tell by that.
Ah, yes.
And just about then I ran out of film. I think I got about 13 or 14 photos there. These guys were jumping on top of the van. These are the prisoners. There were no arms on them. That was taken from the side of the road.
Were these the prisoners that were sort of in the bumper car?
No.
No?
No.
Do you know what happened to those prisoners?
They were still at the where the bumper cars were. And obviously the Greeks knew that because they didn't put any fire on them. They put fire on either side, but they didn't put fire on them. Eventually they marched them off. We've seen them marching them off. They had prison exchanges later on down at Leader Palace, and I was there for one of them, but apparently there's still people missing. A couple hundred or something like that, I'm not really sure. Anyway, and then I seen a group of Turkish soldiers 200-300 yards away, and I noticed it looked like a young girl with them. And it was. I guess she was about 16, 17, and she was just terrified. So I went up, and she spoke English. She said, "Help me, help me." I said, "Okay, we'll look after you, don't worry." These Turks were all, I think you'd imagine what they were going to do. And if they did, that she'd be a life of a prostitute, because no Greek would ever go with her again. So I just took her, and I walked her probably another 500 meters to a kilometer, I can't remember now, to which was the outer edge of Nicosia. And then I seen some Greek soldiers there, and I handed her over to them. And about a month later, I ran into them downtown. I ran into her and her mom and dad, and she pointed me out, and she was crying, and you know, so it was pretty neat. So then, what else did we do? The Colonel Manuel came down, who was the commanding officer at the time. He was actually the deputy commander of the Airborne Regiment, but Colonel Lassard hadn't come over yet. And he came down and he said, "What's going on here?" And I told him, and he sort of took over and negotiated. Pretty forceful guy, Greek guy. And he's looking down at that little Turkish guy. And he said, "You tell this guy that we got all kinds of tanks up there, and we got this, and we got this." And I said, "Sir, we don't have any of that." He said, "He doesn't know that." So I told him. And the old Turk, he perked right up, and just trying. And then we basically stayed with Colonel Beatty the rest of the day. You know, we'd go out and look around. If we'd see something, we'd go look and check it out. You've got to think that we come under fire about, or come under fire, or there was firing going on throughout the day. Might be go for a couple of minutes, might last 10, 15 minutes. They get everybody stopped firing, then it started again. And then when it got dark, the firing stopped. There was no mortars or artillery, which we were really lucky, because we had nowhere to go. We were all above ground. And so were the Turks. They didn't have any trenches dug or anything like that. And I think the Greeks were all in buildings and behind sandbags and things like that. And I remember going back to camp, I guess it was 8 o'clock at night or something like that, by the time we got back. Yeah, but I think it was the next day that I went down with Colonel Manuel. I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure. Mm-hmm. Because we moved 100 people into the airport, and they had everybody. They had cooks, they had guys from the post office. We just didn't have any soldiers. Do you want me to carry on with this?
Oh, yes.
So, we went up the airport, and one of the guys who was in the post office had been in the Van Dues, the Royal 22nd, and he had the 106 recoilless rifle course, and they had a recoilless rifle. So he got that, and he trained these other two postal guys who never had anything like that on how to load it, you know, and he would fire it, aim it, and fire it, and all the rest of it, things like that. And our guys were... They were trying to dig in, and they were trying to find positions around the airport. It's an international airport. Big place. So that night, we were pretty scared, because the Turks kept saying, they're coming. And about 11 or 12 o'clock at night, we got word that the Royal Air Force had two Phantom jets, sitting with the pilots in Akrotiri, which is about 3 minutes flying time. So we got a little cocky then. And then at 2 or 3 in the morning, this British Armored Car Regiment drove up. They were still wearing their black berets. See, in Cyprus, they've got what they call SBA, Sovereign Base Areas, which are like little parts of England. And they weren't part of the UN. They're there back to the colonial days. They're still there. Dekelia and Akrotiri, I think. But these guys rolled in, and they were in their armored cars. And as they were getting out of their armored cars, we were giving them a blue ray. We made them instant UN. So I asked the staff sergeant, "Have you got anything?" Because Turks had tanks. And I said, you got to knock those tanks? And they said, yeah, we got the swing fire missile. That'll knock out any tank in the world. So we were pretty cocky then. Yeah.
Did you ever have to use it?
No, we didn't. See, the in actual fact, the Turk's soldier looks like a British soldier in this case here. No, he's wearing like an American outfit.
Right.
So he's probably a Turkish regular army. These guys are wearing the old British helmet. See, these ones here.
Was it hard to sort of tell between them from a long distance away?
What, the Turks and the Greeks, or the
Turks, Greeks, and British?
No.
Because they were all wearing sort of a hodgepodge of...
No, it was pretty easy.
Yeah. But
there's a Greek there, so look what he's wearing for shoes. He's just got his civilian shoes on.
He does.
You know? So the Greeks were, some of them were well dressed, but at least they had uniforms on. We knew who the Turks were. No doubt, they were very aggressive.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever notice any instances in which the Greeks themselves were aggressive as well?
Not that I've seen. There was probably parts along there, but you got to understand that we started at the airport. We went right through Nicosia, and they didn't cross the green line. That was our line, the Canadians. And we basically told them, if you come across, we're gonna open up with you. The guys who were wounded, most were wounded downtown, right around the Leader Palace there, through mortar fire, rifles, being shot, and all the rest of it. So.
And you mentioned that you were at the Leader Palace when there was an exchange of prisoners, correct?
Yeah, it was a big parking lot there. Mm-hmm. And they just rolled in with the buses, and Turks got out of one, Greeks got out of the other, and they just went back to each other and they drove them off.
So it was fairly simple?
Yeah.
Oh.
And hardly any of the Greeks were in uniform. Most of them were in civilian clothes that they'd been wearing when they got captured. Because where the Turk paratroopers went, I believe there was a Greek village there, so they might have caught them there. But apparently, I found out that after the fact, they had heavy casualties. Turkish airborne hit. Mm-hmm. But I ran into a couple. That's when I found out that this Buzz and I was saying, Buzz, why do we keep firing at us? You know, can't they see the parade? So a Turk paratrooper took his helmet off. Well, their airborne parade is the same color as a UN parade. And we were under the assumption it'd be a maroon beret like ours. It wasn't. It was blue. And then when we were talking to the prisoners in the little amusement park, this Turk paratrooper come up and leaned down. He had a .45 pistol in his hand, and the thing went off. It went just, I hit my leg there. It went right up underneath there.
That was close.
So then I was asking if I could have the pistol. No, he wouldn't give it to me. But I got the pistol. Straight in my pocket.
Oh, yeah.
Just in case. And that's Barakoff in the back there. So Barakoff. We've been trying to contact him. We can't find him.
Hmm.
But, so, yeah, a lot of that stuff that's going on, it's so hectic. The old adrenaline's going and everything, you know. You just, it was hard to sit down the next day and figure out what happened.
Hmm. Yeah. So you didn't really... In that time after the invasion, you weren't really able to develop a routine? Would you say?
Oh, yeah.
So it wasn't...
See, I didn't have to go on OP duty down on the line or anything like that. And we also, we stayed up the airport for quite a while. And then when the civilians started to come back, and the commanding officer said, oh, you got some civvies back here, you better come and see. Oh, no, when they hauled me out of there... After the first war, that's when the commanding officer called me in and he said, we got the payroll here for the Turk side, for the Turkish civilians. Take it down there. I said, yeah, could I have a couple of guys to go with me? He said, no, you're the guy in charge of it, so you take it. So I go down the green line, and they're armed to the teeth. They're ready to go. You can't see anything on either side. So I drove through, and I drove into where the Turk headquarters was. Geez, they were on me like... guns at me and everything else like that, and finally this guy come out I think he was an officer, and he asked me, what business do you have here? And I said, I have the payroll for the Turkish civilians. So he just grabbed it out of my hand. I don't know how much money it was. It was in like a suitcase. And I said, I'd like a receipt. He told me in perfect English to F off. So I went back and I told Major Harries, I said, that's what he told me. He said, don't worry about it. I said, the only thing I'm worried about is I'm happy I'm back here. Yeah. Then I went down. During this time, I had another friend of mine. He was in charge of the sewage, I guess you call it utilities. And they used to have these trucks that come up, and we call them the Suckum trucks, because you know what I mean, eh, for septic fields?
Yeah, sucking up there.
So he said, I got to go find the Suckum truck. Come on with me. And I said, Jesus, Jack, I don't know. Come on, let's go. So we go down there. The old Suckum truck was shot full of holes. It was a mess. And at the end of the truck, there's a trench there, and this Greek comes out, and he had a Thompson 45, a Thompson submachine gun, he's trying to cock it. Well, I said, Jack, look at that guy, don't shoot. I said, why? He said, the guy's a retard. I said, what do you mean he's a retard? He said he can't even open a weapon, it's rusted shut. I said, okay. So I was pretty, I'm glad I was there.
Yeah?
Glad I was there. I really seen stuff that you shouldn't see, you know. Because you still think about it, you still have dreams about it. And I never started having dreams till 24 years after.
Oh, really?
24 years.
Wow.
And I dreamt about the guy's leg coming off. Because my wife woke me up and I was just covered in sweat. And I went to grab her. She, Tom. And I said, what were you dreaming about? And I said, I was dreaming about Cyprus. And she said, Tom, that's almost 25 years ago. So I went and seen my doctor. And I told him about it. And he said, you got PTSD. I said, I don't have PTSD. He said, sure you do. Or you would never be. So he said, you don't have to go to a shrink or anything, but you've got PTSD. He said, you got a mild case of PTSD. Mm-hmm. I said, oh, okay.
So you never experienced anything like that until 24 years
later? Yeah. See, we came back from the Gulf. There was a Navy commander there. We had to fill out this questionnaire. Of course, me being the RSN, big macho guy, I'm not, you know, not worried about this, but the amount of people that had PTSD from the Gulf, which wasn't as bad as Cyprus. Some of the stuff they seen after, well, like we were there right after the war, almost immediately after the war. Some of the stuff they seen was really, really bothered them. And then I think a lot of it is when they come back here and they see people walking around and with that don't give a shit attitude, and you know, you just think, you don't know how good you got it. But yeah, I'm getting off track here.
Well, what was it like for you returning home after Cyprus?
Well, I didn't come home. I went to Germany.
Oh, yes.
Because I'd arranged for my wife to go to Germany. My kids weren't in school yet. So, wait a minute. Yeah, they went to a British school in my wife's hometown because there was British troops were stationed there, and if they paid a certain amount of money, they could go to the British school. Because when I went to see them, when I finished in Cyprus and I went over there, they had British accent. That's the point, Daddy. So we stayed. I had 2 months leave, so we stayed the 2 months. And while I was there, I got a phone call from Captain St. John, who was my troop commander. He said, got a posting if you want it. I said, where to? He said, back to Germany. I said, I'll take it. Why don't I just stay over here? He said, no, you got to come back. So I told my wife, I said, why don't you just stay here and I'll go back and it's only going to be a couple of months. No, you go, I'm going. So she came back with me. We got a married quarter that was only going to be available until August because they turned them all over to NATE, Northern Alberta Institute of Technology. They were taking all the old married quarters. It's down by the industrial airport in Edmonton itself. So we had a place till August, and that's when we went back to Germany. So it worked out. But even Germany, it's different from Canada, but it's not that much different. I mean, you've got all your freedoms and everything else just like you do here. It's just because you're Canadian, you know the Canadian attitude. You know how they, They see everything on TV, and oh, it's no big deal. Kids are playing these video games, they see these people falling down when they get shot. Yeah, when you get shot down, it really hurts.
So, just to come back to Cyprus, yeah. What is your opinion of how the UN handled the situation?
Well, I hear... See, I don't like to... I guess they did a good job. I hear certain contingents didn't do as good a job as they could have. And it's not mainly their fault, because they don't. Most of them are a lot of they're call ups. Right? They get they're in there. A lot of these countries have you go in for 18 months or a year, do your military service. I met one Finnish guy that had about 8 or 9 UN ribbons, and he said, "Oh yeah, they call me up, I go." But for hard infantry and stuff like that, there's nobody like us over there. Now, saying that, prior to the invasion, now that I think of it, they 4 or 2 Royal Marine Commandos showed up in one of the sovereign base areas, and 10 Princess Mary Gurkhas. Now, you don't find any more troops more offensive than that.
Really?
So they showed up, but they didn't wear the blue beret. And they must have been there for a reason, because you don't normally post troops like... Well, you don't normally post troops like us, like the airport at the UN. We were supposed to go to Egypt and Israel in October. That's when they had the Yom Kippur War. We were all down in California. We jumped in there on a major exercise. And then within 36 hours, they'd flown us all back to Edmonton to get ready to go over to Egypt. And then, see, the Yugoslavs used to basically represent the communist side. And people like us represented the U.S. side. Because at that time, the U.S. didn't participate in U.N. deployments. It came down through the communist side that sending a Canadian airborne, they're an offensive unit. That didn't mean we stink. You know. So we didn't go. And everybody was really let down. Because, you know, hey, we're going to go do something more to our liking, you know. So I guess it seemed like they gave us Cyprus as a pat in the back. You guys did a good job. You guys, you go over there, and what happens? Bloody war starts.
Mm-hmm. So, was the Canadian airborne suitably equipped for handling the situation and carrying out its duties?
We had no armored support. We had no artillery. I can't say if we even had mortars. I don't know. I think we just had basic firearms.
What did you have yourself?
I had a rifle and a pistol. Pardon me, I had a submachine gun and a pistol. I got the pistol after the first war. Couldn't spare pistols. One bullet for me. So, I think I'm carrying it right here. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Carrying a submachine gun right there. And that's what he's got there, too. It was like a Sten gun. We had the Sten gun before that. Then we got the Sterling submachine gun. Held a 30-round magazine. It's a pretty good weapon. That's in Blue Beret Camp, by the way. But I think the men were trained.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they didn't back down. They stuck their faces right in there, and they didn't... As a matter of fact, we were pretty proud of one commando, because they were relatively a bunch of new guys.
Oh, really?
A lot of them were from Quebec, right out of Quebec, didn't speak English.
Had any of them ever been in, like, a conflict area like that before?
No, basically, none of us had. Mm-hmm. Well, we had some of the old Sergeant Majors been in Korea. We might have had one or two that were in World War II, but... Some of the signals guys might have been in the Congo in the early 60s. But other than that, no. I only had one ribbon up. I had the CD, the Canadian Decoration, for 12 years of undetected crime. That's, most of the guys had nothing. Just their wings.
Do you think that because you've never been somewhere like that before, does it make it more, have more an impact on you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was... We come out of there pretty good. I mean, there was a lot of respect for us when we come out of there, the Airborne Regiment. Not what happened years down the road in Somalia, but Yeah, we were feeling pretty good about ourselves because we didn't move. They didn't move us an inch. So
what's your opinion of the Canadian media coverage of the Cyprus situation?
The what?
The Canadian media coverage of the Cyprus invasion.
Well, my cousin, I was raised with her. She was 12 years older than me. She said they knew very little about it. I didn't see any reporters.
Mm-hmm.
Hardly anybody. I don't. I think it was very, very poor. See, it wasn't like nowadays where you can pick up a telephone. Like when I was in Kuwait, I could phone home, and it was just like I was phoning you in Vancouver Island. Mm-hmm. We didn't phone then. It was call letters, and if you tried to phone, you might get through. Most of the times, no. But media coverage, I don't recall any.
Do you wish it could have been better? Do you think it should have been?
Well, probably because you want to boast a little bit, eh? That's the only reason. No, I never thought of it. I'll give you an example. When we went to Kuwait, we had a reporter who was there for 3 weeks. Then they sent two reporters over from, I can't remember, somewhere in southern Ontario, come over. Everybody's coming over to get the picture taken in front of the oil fires. But we had a guy came from the Chilliwack Progress that wrote outstanding articles on all the guys. Put their pictures in the paper. It was really good. All these young guys, they thought that was just ticky. Well, he's a great guy. I think he works in Surrey or Langley now. Andy Halota's name. Great guy. If he's still working.
Mm-hmm.
20 years ago.
So what memories have stuck with you the most? Are there some situations that have stayed with you more than others?
I think when I seen the guys getting shot, and the young guy who pulled his leg off, right? For 22 years old, like I was 31, I was an old guy, really. Yeah, and you think of that. I mean, he had no reason to die. And then those other guys who were just lined up and shot, they didn't even have a chance. That's one thing to die in combat. It's one thing to be laid up, put up against, or just stand there and they shoot you. I mean, but there, I think the Greeks respected life more than the Turks did. The Turks were a lot more bloodthirsty.
Mm-hmm.
They're very, very, very strict in their military. It's almost scary. And the Turks are more a happy-go-lucky, friendly people. You know. But that sticks in my mind. I had some good times to stick in my mind, too. I can't tell you about those.
Oh, you can't?
No, I can't.
No? Okay. Well, do you have anything else to add? We've gone through all my questions already.
A fast talker.
Yeah.
No, it turned out probably the biggest thing that ever happened in my 35 years. I was over there with a bunch of guys that I respected. Well, I don't have the words to tell you how much I respect them. I mean, we all wore the same hat badge. We all wore the same thing on our shoulder. You didn't have like a PCLI hat badge or a Vandu hat badge or an engineer hat badge. You all wore the same hat badge. We all knew who was who. Might not know the guy personally, but we knew what he was. That's, and the cohesiveness like that. Like when you're serving in an engineer unit, saying, for instance, when I was here in Chilliwack, when I was a sergeant major in Chilliwack, well, the rest of the brigade spread from Winnipeg to Edmonton, in Shiloh. So you might see those guys once a year when you go to Wainwright. And even when you go to Wainwright, you're in a different camp. You know, they got you in a different bivouac. So you know. And then you might know some of the other senior NCOs. You might have been on a certain course with them or something like that. But the guys don't have the day-to-day contact like we did over there. They're together all the time. You know. And then the infantry guys, they seen the engineers picking up live mines in that. They went, wow, because in peacetime, you put concrete mines in the ground,
mm-hmm.
you know, just to go through the motions, so to speak, or you put out mine tape. Don't go there, that's a minefield. Then they see it, what happened. They had an APC run over the mine and blew the track off. They said, wow, you know, this is a real thing. And then I remember the day that the wounded all came up. Like we had it in Blueberry Camp, they had the Austrian Field Hospital. And it's just like a mass unit. But they were in a building. The buildings we were in were built for the Jewish right after the war when they were going through Palestine. And that's where they hold them there. And so that's, anyway, they had one or two buildings for, and they were only single story. Just, I don't know if I got, I don't think I got a picture. And, no. Anyway, they were getting off the back of the truck, those that could walk. The guys that were shot in the upper arms and things like that. There was one guy named Meisner, he took a... Do you remember at the luncheon there that Captain Jolly, John Jolly was telling us about...
Yeah, Jolly.
...getting that piece of shrapnel in his... He said it was about that big. Well, I ran into Meisner, I don't know, about 10 years ago in Edmonton, and... I said, how's your ankle? He said, I still got problems with it because it just destroyed his. I said, did you have to get out? He said, I didn't have to get out, but I couldn't do everything. So it slowed down his, well, stopped his promotion. So they don't take that into consideration. Yeah. That sticks in my mind. Going to the, once we relocated our foreman, he invited me and five other guys out to his place. They put a big feast on him for us. And he had two daughters, Helen, who was older, really nice, and she took me for a walk around the village, and there was a Greek wedding going on, and she explained everything that was going on there. And then there was Stevie. She was 16 or 17 and absolutely beautiful, but she had rotten teeth. So I set it up with our dentist. Can you fix this girl up? Sure.
Oh, wonderful.
Took her in, and oh, she was just... And... So we had this banquet. You think you're finished eating and you just keep bringing it on. You know, God, it was... Andreas Michalides was his name. He's got to be dead or he's close to it because he was 50-odd then. So, and he looked like a typical Greek guy. Just really friendly smile, you know, and he was just so... He did... Some things were so very dainty, the way he did everything was so particular, you know, like I'm kind of rough around the edges, and we got along so good. And another thing that I remember is, when the Turks landed, they landed around Kyrenia.
Yeah.
And we had two engineers up there. They're two of the guys that got medals, Dolzell and Banfield. And for a couple of days, we didn't know where they were. And they did quite a few things that were really way above their pay grade. I'll tell you, this British major wanted to put them in for a British medal. They were protected. They took all the Greeks and they put them in this one hotel and they wouldn't let the Turks in. There's two guys, corporals. And because we had a diving, we had like a mini leave center up there. There was 19 beds, and any of the soldiers that were in the regiment, they could go up and learn how to dive. They had a Greek guy with a boat, and he was just like that with the Canadians, and they'd take him out, and he knew all the places to go. Take him out, I call it Atlantis. You go underwater there, you see all these old columns, you know, Greek columns sticking up and stuff like that. It was beautiful. So we had a diving section there, and we'd send groups of guys up there to go on these diving courses. And of course, those beds, if any British soldiers showed up, Canucks got any room for us, we put them up too. But the Turks came ashore not far from there. The landing craft looked just like D-Day. And it was American ships too, old ships, but they were still working.
Yeah.
And they came ashore there. And then, because Kyrenia's not very big, it's strictly straight off a postcard. It's beautiful. Just go up there and relax. And we got them back. So everybody's happy about that, and you know, I venture to say if we'd had any more killed, things would have got a little rough on the other, because I don't think our guys would have taken any more of that.
Mm-hmm.
They shot both of our guys in the back.
Really?
Yeah. And with Perron, he... No, this is hearsay. Apparently he was getting a tryout with the Oilers when he got back to Canada.
Tell us a bit about that.
They were WHA then, or WHL. And the doctor was right on him. But there's no way. I guess the guy had more holes in his... And I mean, he actually had him in a helicopter. And the doctor did everything. Couldn't save him. So, and the other burger, they were out. I think they were rescuing this guy's goats or something. This guy's goats had strayed out to no man's land. And they were trying to get these goats out. Things like that. I did something real stupid one night. One of the civilian workers came to camp. His grandmother was stuck on the other side. And could I go out to the end of this road and pick her up? And I said, yeah, I'll do it. And I shouldn't have. But I did. You don't tell anybody that. Because I would have been up to it in there. You know. But I got her. And I dare say I wasn't the only one that ever did something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Guys were doing... The phony part, I think, I remember I was there, and we found out that our commanding officer, Colonel Lassard, was getting the Medal of Bravery. Well, who the hell wrote him up for the Medal of Bravery? Himself? You know, we were going, why the hell is he? Manuel, the first guy, should have got it. Manuel's dead now. He died of cancer. Christ. I should show you some. Maybe this might help if we just have a look at this.
Yeah, but also, I sort of thought of a question when you were talking. As an engineer, did you handle mines yourself? Were you, like, involved?
No, because
in that?
I wasn't. No, because they already had the field, what they call the field troop.
Okay.
They're all combat engineers. Well, so am I. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't employed in that field troop. And to take me out of my job and put me in charge of a bunch of guys who have already been working for this other guy, that just disrupts mm-hmm. things, eh?
Okay.
There's Manuel. He was originally Black Watch, the kilts.
Yeah.
And it was the PPCLI were having their birthday down in Calgary, so we went down to jump in. Anybody, I was ex-PPCLI, so I was allowed to go and all the rest of it. Well, he jumped off wearing a kilt, and he had a broom between his legs. That's BD.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he looks impressed me. He's a little short-ass guy. He was...
Was he at the luncheon?
Hey?
Colonel B.
No. He lives down in Ottawa. He's got Parkinson's now, and he wrote a book. And he used to phone me about once a week and ask me, because when we're down at this amusement park, this British Brigadier General showed up, a Brigadier showed up, and this British W01 Chief Warrant Officer, and man, they were so full of themselves, you know, mere colonials, because all the Brits always looked down their nose, and I couldn't stand either one of them. But we come under the Code of Service Discipline, so you got to pay the proper respects. That was one of the reasons why I asked BD if we could take a look around and get away from these two assholes. So what was I going to say? Oh. So BD decides to write a book. It's called The Bulletproof Flag or something like that. I mean, he's got me born in Prince George. I was born in Winnipeg.
Is that what you wrote that write-up for?
Yeah. Because I didn't take it with me. I still had it back in Canada, but I was trying to... And I'm not sure. It's pretty close. But anyway, he wrote this book, and he put me born in Prince George, B.C. I was born in Winnipeg. My son, I got the book, eh? But hey, Dad, he didn't tell us you were born in Prince George. I said, I didn't tell you a lot of things. I said, what do you see that? He's right here. So he would phone me about once a week, sometimes twice. And do you remember, and this brigadier's name was Hen, H-E-N-N. Do you remember what Brigadier Hen said to me at this time and all? I said, sir, I said, you know, that was in 74. This is like 95. And I said, remember I wasn't in there very much? He said, yeah, but I thought you might have remembered. I said, no, I don't remember anything like that. So this was going on, and it was really trying on my mind. I mean, this guy is... And I thought there was something wrong, so I got a hold of the guy, Joe Drouin. He runs the airborne kit shop out of Gatineau now, who I've known for years. And Joe is pretty close with all these guys. Joe was an airborne trucker. So I phoned Joe, and I said, Joe, this guy's calling me all the time. I said, it's really disrupting. You know, I was really laying it on. I said, would you say something to him? So Joe did. So a couple of years ago, we flew to Ottawa for the anniversary of the Cyprus invasion. And there was about six of us went down from Chilliwack, and he was there. And the first time I seen him was when I went in the museum, the day that Andrew Birch had us all over the museum, and going, there's a Cyprus display, and that picture there of me is there. Well, he was sitting there, and I could feel this guy tugging on my pant. I looked down, it was Beattie. But he couldn't talk, and his wife says, he still recognized you. I said, yeah, man, yeah, it's really nice. And he said, he can't talk now. I said, oh, that's too bad, you know. Said, what do you say? I can't talk anyways. I thought you were a dork. This was my CO in, that's Major Harry's.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to find, that was Roger St. John, best officer I ever had. Died about 2 years ago, younger than me, top shape. He had some kind of lump behind his heart, which they couldn't.
What were your living conditions like when you were in Cyprus?
Well, I'm trying to find a, I could better show you if I could pick a building. They're all right. They're, that's the guy that got badly wounded in the ankle. Meister.
Meister.
Yeah.
Were you ever wounded yourself?
No. Just, I broke my arm in a jump. It hurt. And this is what we used to do in the afternoon. Barbecues. If you weren't on duty, I mean, it's so bloody hot.
Yeah.
You know, if you're on OP duty, you're on there all the time. You get spelled off. And,
mm-hmm.
But here, we're having a sports day. You see, they he's one of my guys, Cockridge. And I, a couple of years ago, he called me from Fort St. John. He said, Tom, they're operating on me. I got to have open heart surgery. And I said, Jesus, Gordon. And he said, yeah, not only that, Leanne and I just get a divorce. I said, jeez. So I ended up spending 2 months in my place recovering. This is the guy who owns the book. He's a big Cree. Comes from Driftwell, Alberta.
Hmm.
And he's a transportation supervisor for Chilliwack School District. He's the guy that got me driving school bus. He joined up when he was 16, boy soldier. They used to do school in the morning and army stuff in the afternoon, and that was 2 years. And he got me down driving bus because he said, the boss knows you. And I said, from where? He said, you're on course with him in 69. He's an Air Force. He was an Air Force guy, Gary Clark. I said, yeah, Gary. So I go down there, and he says, Tommy, you're going to come and drive school bus? I said, I don't have a license for that. No, I'm going to train you. So I did it for 9 years.
Wonderful.
These guys are all engineers. Well, that's Banfield, he got a medal. And that's Dozell, he got a medal. And he got a medal. Roy Kyler, Keith Shaw, Sticky Lepage. That's why we call him Sticky. Jerry Bronze, we just found him when I went to that Cyprus reunion. Terry Lockhart, we called him Duck Ass because in the 50s we had those haircuts, you know, and he combed him in the back.
Oh, yes.
We'll call it Duck Ass. So he used to still comb his hair like that. And the sergeant major would always get on him, Duck Ass, get over here. So he lives over here. No, he lives by Gibson's.
Mm-hmm.
Still Terry Duck Ass. There's the jail where I spent a few days.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Keeping my mouth shut.
Not going to tell me about that.
No.
Okay.
Actually, I will. It's a true story, and it's should have never happened, but it did. I'm still trying to find out. They're firing a Sterling submachine gun there.
Oh, okay. So how did you spend most of your free time? Did you usually have, like, activities planned? Or?
You could go to Regina Street where all the girls were.
Oh, of course.
just to talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's Roger St. John. Yeah. I can't believe there's not a picture of it. find Blueberry Kid. We had a variety show come over. Canadian artist. I didn't see it myself. But my son's friend, my friend's son, did three tours in Afghanistan. And the person that came over there that impressed him the most was Cassie Campbell, who was captain of the Canadian women's hockey team. She signed everybody's hat. She was just, of course, I don't care. Well, here's the Grease Pig Contest. I'm in the Grease Pig Contest. I think there's...
Did you catch it?
Okay, caught more than that. What had happened was, when they were putting up the who's going to be in money bet, they put me in the Grease Pig Contest. So my foreman heard about it. And he said, Mr. Walton, if you go in that, the workers will lose a lot of faith in you because you just don't do that. So I went to the sergeant major and explained it to him. He said, I don't give a gun, you're in it. So the day of that thing there, we're down there, it's hotter than hell. They drive the deuce and a half truck up and they open the tailgate. There's this little pig, about that long.
Like a little over foot.
It was a piglet.
Yeah.
So they take it off the truck, put it down. There's me and another guy got to catch it. Well, the pig won't run. Too bloody hot. So guy with me takes his lighter out and puts it under the pig's ass, and it jumped about 10 feet. The next thing I know, this sergeant major calling me over. He tore a strip off me right in front of everybody, including women and children, because some of the other contingents could take it. I climbed over the fence and I took off. And I went down to Regina Street and I got loaded. So the next morning, about 9 o'clock, 7 o'clock, we're out doing PT. At 9 o'clock, I'm still in bed. So one of the guys came over and said, Tom, the sergeant major wants to see you. I said, probably does. So I took my time and had a shower and everything. I walked over and I said, Master Corporal Walton reporting, sir. And he said, for 2 cents, I'd throw you in jail. And I said, fill your effing boots. And he did. And I went to jail. 17 days. Soldier awaiting trial. Queen's regulations in order. You're only supposed to be 7 days. But airborne standard, keep leaving there for a while. So.
What did you do when you were in jail?
Well, if you're awaiting trial, you don't have to work. But we had an airborne MP section. These guys were all paratroopers, too. The guy that came and got me was a guy named Rick Burns. We're still good friends. He's about 6'5". So he comes pick me up in the Jeep. He said, do I need the cuffs, Tom? I said, geez, the closest land is Turkey, and that's 42 miles, Rick. That's what. So he laughed, and he takes me down there. And the other guy's name was Ev Summerfield, who is now very high-ranking in the RCMP. Couldn't even tell us when he was in Ottawa what his job is. He gave us an address. If you guys want to get a hold of me, it's my address. Don't pass it around. No, for me. He said, I'll be out of the country for 2 years. We said, okay. So anyway, they come up and see me. He said, Tom, you smoke, don't you? I said, yeah. You go to work? Yeah. If I didn't work, I didn't smoke. So I'm out with a corn broom, and the cobblestones is all ahead there. And I'm out there with these corn brooms sleeping, and all my guys are walking. Hey, look, who's there? They're like, that's embarrassing. But we had jungle boots on. They took all my laces away. They give me a set of coveralls that was 3 sizes too big. They probably fit good now. And the guy before me had just had a haircut. So didn't get showers, maybe, one a week?
And this was all before the invasion, right?
Yeah. So anyway, I go up in Order Street. That's like your trial. And I go in front of Colonel Manuel. And he asked me, what do you plead? And I said, guilty, sir. So I got a $175 fine. I thought I was going to be stripped or private. And he says to the RSM, march him out. So as I'm going out, and he halts me in the hallway, and he said, go in that room there and get your clothes on. And on the table is your wallet and your leave pass. Leave pass. And he said, and Corporal Demeter's in there too. That's one of the guys from my section. So I go in there and I said, what's going on, Jack? He said, we're on a 48-hour pass. We're going to Famagusta. I got the taxi coming. So a taxi costs about £2, £3. It's not that big. So we get to Famagusa's, all these luxury hotels, and there's busloads of tourists coming in every day, mostly from Britain and Sweden, Europe. And so we go up in the room, and Jack's got a big bottle of whiskey, and we're sitting out in the patio having a drink, and all of a sudden we hear this bang, and we looked over the side, and there's a tank going up the road shooting. It's a Russian tank, a Russian-made tank, but it was Greeks. So about an hour later, knock on our door, and it's the Swedish military police. You're coming with us. Get your stuff. You're coming with us. And we all went up to their camp. And this is when the coup took place, when Samson kicked out Macarius.
Mm-hmm.
See, Samson was a wanted man by the Brits for executing British soldiers.
Yeah, I bet.
And I'd seen Macarius. I went to one other church. Anyways.
They call him Black Mac.
Yeah. So anyway, we go to the Swedish camp. They put us in a room with just two of us, with a concrete floor, no bedding, nothing. So we went to their PX, and we bought two bath towels each, and we put them down as bedding. So we were there for 2 days because they had Nicosia encircled. They couldn't get in or out. So we finally could get in. They took us back, and as soon as I got in the camp, there was my commanding officer. He says, "How you feeling?" I said, "Not bad, sir." And he said, "No one to keep my mouth shut." He said, "Good idea." He said, "We have orders tonight at 1800 and Sergeant Smith." I said, "I can't go in there, sir." He said, "You can't sew for orders." So I walked in there that night. CO says, "Gentlemen, say hello to Sergeant Walton." I got promoted.
Jailing different.
I had a friend of mine tried it. It didn't work.
Oh, no.
He's a really good friend of mine. He lives in Chilliwack, Bob Fringon. Mm. Still looks the same. Hasn't gained an ounce.
Wow.
Oh, wait. I can't believe they don't have a picture. There's me with a grease pig.
Hey, you caught it.
Yeah.
So much trouble over a grease pig.
Yeah. And then we get into war.
So did it come as a shock when the coup occurred?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I said to Jack, I said, "The Turks will be here within a week." 6 days later, they invaded it. See, there's a British armored car. It's called a Ferret. And we used to have Ferrets in the Canadian Army. And they're like a scout car, but they could put missiles on the side of them. They're not. They're museums now. I hate to drag this out. I'm just trying to find
it. Don't know it's fine.
It's when the rest of the regiment showed up. Anyway, that's about like the quarters were like that.
Okay.
And they were... All you had between your bed space was your locker.
Mm-hmm.
But those days that was not uncommon. Most of the time we were sleeping on the field. Okay. So, they're fine. Mm-hmm. Just trying to find.
Did you know him well?
I didn't know him.
Oh, you didn't?
No. There's the two MPs, Sergeant Burns, Corporal Summerfield. Just trying to find. I'm pretty sure I was over there. Oh, here we go. Yeah, when this book was, I was Master Corporal. When they put the book in.
Hmm.
Yeah. Are you going? Did you say you're going to hang on to that? Or?
I have John Jolie.
Oh, yeah, you've got that. So, yeah, it was good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly good. You always remember the good times. I remember I met a guy who was in the headquarters in Six. Him and I went through basic training together. And he's not a big guy, but he always liked to fight, mm-hmm. especially when he got a few drinks. So we went... Along Regina Street, they have these sandwich bars, or gyros.
Oh, gyros, yeah.
You know, they have the big, and they just cut. So we're going, we're down drinking most of the night. We're heading on our way back. We're going to stop and have a sandwich. So we go there, and these four British soldiers come in. Hey, look at those FMIs. And I was going, oh, Jesus, Lord. And I said, shut up. Bloody fight starts. I said, he throws one punch and leaves, and I got all four of them.
Oh, dear.
So this one guy smacked me right there, and it just cut. It's right on the bone, eh? And we wore these light-colored shirts. You can see them in the pictures. And it was just blood all over. So then somebody yelled, the unfacit police are coming. That's United Nations Force in Cyprus. They're military police in different countries. They're coming. So took off, and I can't remember the name of this bar, but it's downstairs. And I ran downstairs, and it was one of the whiskey dollies. These are girls who used to come and sit with you. Buy me whiskey. And you'd pay 15 cents, and they'd get colored water. You know, it's supposed to be a drink. It's colored tea. It's tea or something like that. But she took me right behind the bar into the back, took my shirt off, and put it in a tub of cold water right now. And she said, just sit over there and don't say nothing. So they came down looking. They didn't catch me. And
had some excitement.
Yeah. We had medals parades there. You have to get 90 days in theater for a medal, for the UN medal. Well, gee, all UN medals are the same. It's just the ribbon color that's different.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what else to tell you.
Well, if that's...
I went on... I got UN leave over there mm-hmm. in June... I had a week's leave, so I went to Germany. And on the way home, we were flying in a Herc from Lahr, Germany. We had to stop in Ismailia, in Egypt. So we landed, the Herc broke down. And it was just when, you probably never heard of this, they shot down one of our Buffalo aircraft, and I think there was 12 or 13 guys on it. Mm-hmm. And as we're flying into Ismailia, we're flying along the canal, and you can see all these... On the Egyptian side, all these goddamn guns. So we landed, and we had to stay overnight. They had like what they call it a transient tent. Anybody that got stuck there, just go in there. And next morning I woke up, and all my eyeball looked like a golf ball with a slit. So I went down to the MIR, medical inspection room. And the medic looks at me and said, there's about 14 insects over here that do things. We don't know what they are. So we can't give you nothing for it. So we flew out 2 days later, and I go back to Cyprus, and it just went away. But that was an experience. The guy drove me into Suez City, a friend of mine, and because I wanted to see a little bit of Egypt. I mean, it's all mostly desert. And they were having a victory parade. I said, what are they doing? He said, they're having a victory parade. I said, they lost. Not according to them. Different people over there, I'll tell you. Mm-hmm. So... So when I came back to Canada, I did another year in the regiment, exercises in the Arctic, and we went to Jamaica, spent 5 weeks in Jamaica. I could have stayed there.
I can only imagine.
Didn't like the Arctic.
You didn't like the Arctic?
Cold, so bloody cold. But that's about it, Camus.
All right.
Can't think of anything else. Probably on my way home, I'll say, why didn't I tell her this?
Well, it's been a pleasure listening to you. And thank you so much for coming and talking to me.
I was going to tell you at the start, if I start to waffle, just put your hand up and I won't be insulted.
Go ahead.
Start to waffle on sometime, you know, and I get off the subject and that. It's like some of the guys, the guys in the Legion that haven't been there, haven't done that. Oh, no, not again. We're going to get our helmets on. You guys are telling war stories again. But at the airborne luncheons we have once a month, when the guys from World War II are talking, we listen.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty proud outfit. They stopped having their annual get-togethers because of a lot of them are not in good enough shape to travel because they all travel from across Canada. And their membership is below 600. See, at D-Day alone, they lost 300, and they only had 600 and something in the battalion. So they lost 300 and something. Man, that's heavy. Yeah. But But they always say, yeah, you should see the number of Germans we took out.
Yeah.
That's been my pleasure. Mm-hmm. My pleasure meeting you. And if you're ever in Chilliwack, I'd sure like to take you to one of the luncheons.
That would be wonderful. Keep you informed.
Bring your recorder.
Yeah.
First Wednesday of every month. Except in, we don't have it in June because that's when we have our D-Day celebration on the 6th of June. June, July, and August, we don't have it. But every time after that, it's in the Veteran Legion.
Mm-hmm.
You show up, I'll be there.
Or
you just say, I know Tom Walton.
Welcome with open arms.
Oh, yeah.
Well, this concludes the Military Oral History Program interview with Mr. Tom Walton on March 14th, 2012. So while the tape is running, I'm just going to like let you look over the interview release form.
Okay. I think Andrew Birch gave me one of these.
Mm-hmm. Probably just a little different. And take a look at it and make sure you're all right with all the terms and conditions.
I have to write out my full name, eh?
Mm-hmm.
Two K's, isn't it?
Just one K, two S.
Eric.
S-S-O-N. Yeah.
Fourteenth?
The record, we both signed the interview release form. Is this correct?
Yes.
Wonderful. And I guess we're done. Thank you very much, Tom.
Okay.